from the studios of KUSP in Santa Cruz, California. I'm Gary Shapiro, and this is From the Bookshelf. Harlow Giles Unger returns to the show this week. His latest book tells the story of a beleaguered Speaker of the House stymied by an intransigent Congress, and a former Secretary of State with presidential ambitions repeatedly faced with accusations of wrongdoing to the extent that it no longer mattered whether or not the accusations were true. This all sounds very familiar, and yet, Harlow Giles Unger's new book is not about people named Boehner or Clinton, but rather a biography set in the 19th century. The book is Henry Clay, America's Greatest Statesman. Harlow Giles Unger, welcome back to From the Bookshelf.
Thank you very much. It's always a privilege to be with you.
Thank you. You know, this may seem odd to you, but in my entire life, I have never fought a duel.
Never.
Not even once.
Well, it's not as common today as it was in the day of Henry Clay. In the day of Henry Clay, it was quite ordinary to fight a duel. Indeed, when Henry Clay walked into the House of Representatives for the first time, he, at the time, was the youngest member of the House and was immediately elected Speaker. And became the youngest speaker in American history. Most of the members of the House were carrying pistols. A fellow named Philip Derringer in Philadelphia had invented a small pocket-size one-round pistol, and they all carried it. Henry Clay, when he walked in the House, found bedlam. The members of the House were fighting each other, hitting each other, pummeling, wrestling on the floor. After they'd finished fighting each other on the floor, they'd walk outside and stage duels and occasionally kill each other. So it was quite a mess. There was no sense of agreement, no sense of commitment to the nation. They simply were fighting to protect sovereign rights of the states from which they came. Henry Clay had to pull them all together, and did so as the strongest speaker in the history of the House of Representatives. He established the rules of order that remain in effect. Most of them remain in effect to this very day. He took control of the committees, named the chairman at that time only chairman of each committee, and saw to it that the members of each committee were committed to compromise. He realized that the nation was based on compromise, that the nation was founded and built on compromise. The Declaration of Independence was a compromise. Half the people who signed it wanted autonomy, not independence. They wanted to stay British. The Constitution was a compromise between slave states and free states, big states and little states, rural interests and urban interests. And once the national government assumed power, its survival over the next 60 years hinged on five major compromises engineered by Henry Clay, the man I call America's greatest statesman. He held the nation together with these compromises for 60 years until his death, and kept the nation from falling apart into basically the South wanted to secede from the North. He held them together in union so that he could create what he called the American system, a system of transportation, roads, canals, eventually railroads, that linked 20 of the states from California to Maine into a true union whereby tens of thousands of people were able to move freely across state lines, buy land, establish farms, deal with suppliers, out-of-state suppliers, and sell their produce to out-of-state customers. Merchants could deal with people in and out of their own state. People could travel to visit their relatives back in their old states. By the end of his terms in Congress, He had tied the nation up under the American system, where you had 20 million people living in the northern and central states who call themselves Americans now. In 1820, when he engineers his first compromise, the famous Missouri Compromise, most Americans had great difficulty traveling. You could only travel by horseback. Occasionally there were roads for stagecoaches, but most people couldn't travel out of their states. And if you asked the average person what country he came from, he'd say New York, Delaware, Virginia, not the United States of America. Once Clay established his American system and allowed this great commercial network to be established, the average person in the northern, central, and western states, when you ask the name of their country, they'd say they were Americans. They no longer held their allegiance to the states. Only the southern states continued to fight for state sovereignty and insist that their states should have more power than the federal government, and they refused to cede to the federal government. But in the north and in the central area of the country and in the far west, they refused to allow this union to be split by a group of southern plantation owners.
You know, I noticed that for all the shooting that we were talking about earlier, all the shooting in your book, there's only a little bit of killing. I mean, was everyone really like a bad shot in those days?
Yes. These were not professional gunfighters. These were basically lawyers, most of them. Some were judges, and some were merchants and bankers. But they were not professional gunfighters. They were usually among the wealthiest people of the communities that they represented, which is how they gained power in the first place. But they were very, very adamant about retaining power, and were quite opposed at first to Henry Clay's efforts to establish federal controls over certain areas of governance in the United States. By the time he was finished, though, he had so united the states in what later became the Union that to break that up was unthinkable financially, commercially, socially, in every way. It was just it became unthinkable. These men across the country became Americans. And the tragic thing today is that you have a group of representatives, the so-called House Freedom Caucus or Shutdown Caucus, of about 40 congressmen from little areas that are trying to restore state sovereignty and local sovereignty. They don't really believe in the American way of compromise, and they really are mirroring the actions of the Nazis and communists, a small group of radicals who want to take control of the entire house and dictate to the majority. You got this one guy who's been living behind a cactus tree in Arizona, claiming that decisions on the federal level, and I'm quoting him, decisions on the federal level don't represent the will of the people. I don't know if that desert rat has ever been to Boston, New York, Philadelphia, Pittsburgh, or Chicago and talked to the millions and millions and millions of people who live in big cities who've never seen a cactus and who have the same unalienable rights that this Arizona guy has. The irony of the House Freedom Caucus is that one of its leaders, Rick Mulvaney of South Carolina, comes from the same state that fired the first shots in the Civil War. These people just don't believe in the United States of America. They are not good citizens. They are not loyal Americans.
So do you think they want to bring back slavery also? Probably not.
I don't know about Mulvaney in South Carolina. They might probably areas of that there they might like to bring back slavery.
Well, you know, in your book, Harlow Giles Unger, in your new book, Henry Clay, America's Greatest Statesman, so much of the dysfunctional kinds of stuff that we hear about or we read about in the papers today, what was going on then? So is it worse now? Are you saying it's worse now?
Not really. What the problem Americans have, we are a huge diversified population living in a huge diversified nation geographically, so that it's impossible for the interests of flood-ravaged areas of California to have the same interests as areas of drought in other parts of the country. The interests of people in big cities are not the same as the interests of farmers, and they never can be. The net result has been a Congress that historically, in more than 225 years, has only passed 5% of proposed legislation. Only 5% of the laws that are proposed have ever been passed historically in Congress, because it's very difficult to get the interests of each of these areas of the country to find common ground between them. Some people call that dysfunctional. Well, it's not dysfunctional. It's democracy.
Mm-hmm.
Alexander Hamilton said, if you want a legislature and a president and a government that acts efficiently and gets things done, get yourself a dictator. Otherwise, embrace the system we have, and that means respect for others with different views. All Americans have certain unalienable rights, and those rights are equal to yours. Congress only is dysfunctional when it doesn't do what I want it to do. It's terrific. It's a great organization when it does what I want it to do. And so Congress is not dysfunctional. It's exactly what the framers and authors of the Constitution envisioned. James Madison, who wrote the Bill of Rights and was at the Constitutional Convention, explained the intent of the framers. And these are James Madison's words. He said, "Not the rich more than the poor, not the learned more than the ignorant, not the haughty heirs of distinguished names more than the humble sons of obscurity and unpropitious fortune. The electors are to be the great body of the people of the United States, and that's what we have in the House of Representatives." And Henry Clay took over the speakership and turned it into the second most powerful federal office in the land after the president. The speaker is called the elect of the elect. He and the president are the only two members of the federal government, only two elected officials in the land that are elected by all of the people. And once elected, the speaker no longer can debate. He no longer can vote. He takes over the speakership after being elected by the entire House. He's nominated by the majority party, but he's elected by the entire House, and he serves the entire nation. If he's not strong enough to do so, he gets kicked around and at times kicked out, like the Speaker Boehner has just been unmercifully kicked around by these special interest groups who wanted him to serve their bidding and not the bidding of the rest of the nation. And he just wasn't strong enough to stand up to that kind of attack. Henry Clay was. And we must pray as good Americans that our next speaker, whoever he is, studies Henry Clay and models his service as speaker after that of Henry Clay, who said quite simply that if and these are Clay's words, if anyone desires to know the leading object of my public life, the preservation of the Union, will furnish him the key. And that is what should be the primary object of the next speaker.
Well, Harlejaz Unger, you've been studying this, you know, period for so many years, and you've written, you know, I think this is your 600th book on
yeah, 25th.
I was close. And I know you've written many biographies of our founding fathers. Do you think our founding fathers made mistakes? That is, the country that Henry Clay was Speaker of the House for was a country of, I don't know, 10 million people. And now we have 300 million people. When he was in the House of Representatives and when he was Secretary of State, all of the people in government were white men, landowners. Now there are, you know, people of color, women, and so forth. It's a completely different country. Should the founding fathers have foreseen, is there things they could have done that would have eased the governing of this nation?
Well, that's almost like saying, should Christ have foreseen all the sinners in the world today? I think the framers had a vision of a new type of society, and they, at the time, were the leaders of their of this grand society, but the leaders of their individual states and individual communities. And at the time, too, it was an age of deference in which the ignorant did defer to the well-educated, the experienced. And Joe the plumber would have said to a candidate for president, yeah, you take the presidency. I don't know how to run a country. You know better than I do. Now Joe the plumber thinks he knows how to run the nation, as is evidenced with some of the candidates that are running as Republicans, and with no experience in government, with no experience on and thinking they know how to do it. That is a disrespect of education and of experience that is not the American way. So I think they knew there would be mistakes and that they would make mistakes. It was evident right away when the Southerners kept fighting for greater sovereignty, state sovereignty, and fighting the federal government at every turn. And even some of the northern states, when the federal government passed a whiskey tax, farmers out in western Pennsylvania threatened to march on Washington and march on Philadelphia, which was then the temporary capital. And Washington, who was president, had to organize 30,000 troops and march out to the Pittsburgh area to quell the rebellion. Fortunately, the farmers gave up and disappeared before the troops got out there, so there were no deaths, and it ended peacefully. But it was the type of resentment over the federal government at that time, and it was a normal type of resentment. 95% of Americans lived on farms, and a farmer, especially one who has cleared the wilderness and now has a functioning farm of 200, 300, 400, 500 acres, is pretty much self-sufficient and doesn't like to be told how to run his farm. Unfortunately, governments need funds, and governments have to fight wars, and governments have national obligations that require those farmers in that day, and require all Americans today to pitch in and support the federal government.
Oh yeah, that tax thing that that many people in Congress are so opposed to.
Yes, exactly. and many of them they're against paying their own tax, but they want others to pay the taxes.
Well, there was something in your book about a huge, controversy about the congressmen giving themselves a raise. That was like the worst thing they could possibly do.
Yes, today they don't hesitate. and often we don't even know they've given themselves a raise. But the thrust of Henry Clay's Congress and the thrust of federal officials in those days was to hold, to preserve the Union long enough so that it could become this great nation that became the most prosperous nation on earth and stretched from sea to shining sea. That was the vision of Henry Clay. It was the vision of the president he was very close to, James Monroe. And it was the vision of Abraham Lincoln, who really became one of Henry Clay's disciples. Most people don't realize that Abraham Lincoln's wife, Mary Todd, grew up next door to the Clays. Her parents were very close friends of the Clays. And when Clay ran for president, Abraham Lincoln supported Clay, campaigned for him. And he said of Clay, I can express all my views. This is Lincoln now talking. I can express all my views by quoting Henry Clay. I worshipped him as a teacher and leader. He loved his country. He gave a death blow to fraternal strife and peace to a distracted land. This is Lincoln talking before the Civil War had erupted, and Clay had just died. And as Lincoln wooed and married Mary Todd, Clay had become the young Lincoln's friend and mentor. And before he became president, Lincoln served in Congress, where Clay had made compromise the guiding principle, which this Freedom Caucus today doesn't want to follow. Clay died before the Civil War began, but when he died, Lincoln looked to heaven in delivering the eulogy for Clay and cocked his ear and said, I recognize Clay's voice speaking as it ever spoke for the Union, for the Constitution, for the freedom of man. And when Lincoln sent Union forces to war, he explained why in words that really were those had been those of Henry Clay. And President Lincoln borrowed those words, saying, my paramount object in this struggle is to save the Union. It is not either to save or destroy slavery. If I could save the Union without freeing any slave, I would do it. And if I could save it by freeing all the slaves, I would do it. And if I could save the Union by freeing some and leaving others alone, I would also do that. What I do about slavery, I do because I believe it helps to save this Union. And what I don't do, what I forbear because I do not believe it would help to save the Union. Abraham Lincoln, during his short presidency, listened to Henry Clay, and as have all the great statesmen in American history. So we now have to hope that our next speaker will begin to follow, will resume that principle and follow the lead of Henry Clay.
We'll have to send him a copy of Harlow Giles Unger's book, Henry Clay, America's Greatest Statesman.
I hope he has studied about Henry Clay by the time he takes office.
Well, let me ask you about Lincoln and that speech that you had just quoted. I believe that Lincoln was, I know that Lincoln said that, and I'm sure that he was saying that to his constituency, but do you think that he really believed that?
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely.
Was he not opposed to slavery in his soul?
Yes, but so was Henry Clay. But that had nothing to do with their politics. They could do nothing about slavery at that time because slavery was a state issue. You know, Henry Clay was a leading abolitionist and owned slaves, but he could do nothing about Kentucky laws. And Kentucky law made it a crime to emancipate a slave. A slave owner could not free his slaves, did not have that right. He would have been put in jail had he tried to do that. So there were things that certain federal politicians could not do, no matter how strongly they wanted to. But the great leaders in American history, the great statesmen in American history, have all acted to preserve and protect the Union. Washington, Lincoln, Roosevelt, Eisenhower, all these men believed in the principles of Henry Clay, that the preservation of the Union is primary.
I'm sure that Clay sort of saw the potential of civil war in all of his compromises. Would he have been surprised, disappointed when the civil war actually came?
No. When it came, we were a different nation than when he started making the first of his five great compromises. In 1820, had he not succeeded in effecting the Missouri Compromise, that kept the South and the North together in union, had he not succeeded, the South would have split off into a separate nation. Probably some of the central states would have done the same. We would have divided into two, possibly three separate little nations, and no one would have cared. No one in the North would have gone to war to keep the South and in the nation, and to free slaves. They didn't care. There was just as much slavery in the North as there was in the South. Only New England had emancipated the slaves. New York, Pennsylvania, all the other states had slavery. It was legal. And indeed, when New York State tried to abolish slavery, the people in New York rioted and prevented them from doing so. Pennsylvania and New Jersey outlawed the slave trade, but slavery remained legal and indeed emancipation illegal because it was considered a criminal act to deprive people of their property without due process. So there was no talk of freeing the slaves. In 1820, John Brown was only 20 years old. He was getting married and thinking about making babies, not war. So no one would have cared. But what would have happened, and this is what Clay wanted to prevent, the nation, the South, would have seceded. We would have been divided into two, maybe three, small, economically weak, and militarily impotent little nations, and been subject to takeover by one or more of the three great powers of the day, Spain, France, or Britain. It would have been the end of his dream of this great nation stretching from sea to shining sea. He wanted to hold the nation together. So he worked out this compromise in 1820, allowing Missouri to come into the Union as a slave state, balanced by coming into the nation of Maine as a free state. What that did was to keep the balance of power equal in the Congress. Had the South gained a majority, they would have made slavery legal across the whole nation. Had the North gained power, they would have made slavery illegal and emancipated all the slaves. Either one would have caused a civil war. Clay averted that with this compromise that gave a little bit to both sides. And that's what he did in all five of his great compromises. He showed the feuding parties the common ground that they shared and showed them that there's no way either side can have everything it wants, but it can have a little bit. Enough to make some progress, to profit by the compromise, and the other side will also profit, and it won't get everything it wants either. So that was the art of compromise that he was so great at. And in doing so, he allowed several generations of Americans to be born and grow up. So that by 1850, as I say, in 1820, no one would have gone to war to preserve the Union. In 1850, this huge transportation network that Clay helped build, helped conceive and build, tied the nation, 20 states of the nation, from Maine to California, so tightly, commercially, financially, economically, socially, in every way, that all of these people, the 20 million people from Maine to California, consider themselves Americans now. And now this new generation of young people who had never thought about their states, they only thought about their country, they were willing to fight to preserve it. And so that was the difference that Henry Clay made. He held the nation together long enough for it to become a nation, to become a closely knit nation, with the exception of a minority of people in the South.
Well, they don't call Howard Giles Unger the most America's most readable historian for nothing. I enjoy talking to you, and I certainly enjoyed this new book of yours, which is Henry Clay, America's Greatest Statesman. Harlow Giles Unger, thank you so much for spending some time talking to us on From the Bookshelf.
Thank you very much for inviting me.
Well, that's it for this week's From the Bookshelf. I hope you enjoyed the show, and we'll come back and see us again next week. In the meantime, you can subscribe to our podcast at iTunes, visit our podcast page at fromthebookshelf.com, and you can like us on Facebook. I want to thank my guest, historian Harlow Giles Unger. His latest book, Henry Clay, America's Greatest Statesman. From the Bookshelf is produced by Francis Venegas. I'm Gary Shapiro. See y'all next time.